written. So we're starting with the final book of the Odes of Solomon. Remember, he broke it into four parts. And just for review, likely these odes were written during in Syria. And because of the poetic style, they think that it was probably originally Syriac, because when you have really good poetry, if you change languages, it can mess it up. So that's the only language they found it in. It often has the reader speak in first person, so identifying with the Christ or the divine within and having them speak that. It rarely uses the names Jesus or Christ or Anointed One, but it does use Word, Light, the Lord, Son of God, and it was found in a professor's office, lost on his desk, and he doesn't remember where he got it from. So
that's just weird to me.
I know.
I think his wife put it there driving crazy.
Yeah, or maybe he got it in some illicit fashion and
doesn't want to admit. Yeah.
Do we know anything about the professor?
I don't.
Yeah, we know something about him. I mean,
that he was absent-minded and
Germany.
When was it discovered on his desk?
Just in the last 40 years.
In the last 40, 50 years.
It was not found with the Gnostic, but it's when all of those Nag Hammadi and all of that was being discovered in that same sort of time period. Probably, which is what made him look at it, because that kind of stuff was coming into consciousness. But that's the best they can tell him, is it was on his desk, had been there for a while. And what it does identify is worship styles, because it's like things that were psalms and songs that were used in worship. So the fourth book is number 33 to 42. And there were 42 books in all. Has the most embattled songs of the whole collection, which is revealing of the increase in conflicts and difficulties of the Christ community, which also suggests that perhaps they were written or they were compiled in order of being written. So we have 42 psalms, and they start out a lot with praise songs, and by the end they're doing a lot of sort of overcoming, so they probably were a collection that kept being added to. The violence of the Roman Empire that was imposed arbitrarily, also the disintegration of the nation state or tribal identifications, which was creating all kinds of conflict because people had lost their identities. The first one names a corrupter as sort of the nemesis, and others cite other kinds of challenges. But in each case, the Lord comes to the aid of the singer and goodness is reclaimed. So that's the sort of the theme of these processes. One of the neat, there are two that talk about the feminine face of God, number 33 and number 36. Number 33 has a perfect virgin defeat the corrupter and calls humanity back to truth by revealing that the corrupter is a deceptor. And that, so she goes out and calls, says, she comes out and says, however, an unblemished virgin stood, one who was preaching and inviting, and said, sons and daughters of humanity, return yourselves and come. Abandon the ways of that corrupter and come near to me. He led you into wrong, but I will bring you out from ruin and make you wise in the ways of truth. Do not be corrupted nor perish. Hear me and be saved, for I have spoken the generosity of the Lord among you, and you will be redeemed and blessed by my hand. I am your judge. So she wins through her. She helps the defeat the corrupter. And then in number 36, which I thought was kind of a cool one, it shares how the divine 36.
Page 425?
Yeah, 28. Ode 36 on 428. I rested on the Spirit of the Lord, and she raised me up to the high place, and she caused me to stand on my feet in the high place of the Lord, before his fullness and splendor, while I was proclaiming in the preparation of his odes. She gave birth to me before the face of the Lord, and while I was the child of humanity, I was called the light, the child of God, because I was glorified among the glorious, and first among the great ones. For she made me according to the greatness of the Most High, and he renewed me according to his renewal, and anointed me from his fullness. I became one of those who are near him, and my mouth was opened like a cloud of dew, and my heart gushed forth a fountain of justice. and my access was through peace, and I was set up in the spirit of instruction. Hallelujah. So they do a lot of, the writer of the New Testament talks about they were much more comfortable with transgenderizing of God. You have a confused look on your face.
No, I think you already mentioned it. They just seem very psalm-like.
They are, yeah.
Yeah.
That's what they are. That's why they say they pretty much was probably the Jewish Christian community, so they were writing these in the format of the psalms.
Isn't that in the tradition of John?
These aren't, the odes are not necessarily in the tradition of John. The odes were a set of books, and what the author of the New Testament did was divide up the odes, there were 42 of them, into four sections and put them at the beginning of four sections of his, of the New Testament.
Yes, because you look at his literature and tradition of John with an introduction set of prayers.
Yeah, so the introduction set of prayers is that.
You look like Ode 21, I lifted my arms to the height. And the Psalms is, I lift thine eyes unto the Lord from help.
From whom are helping out? Yeah, there are a lot of very similar kinds of, except that it's also very Christian. Clearly, the language uses Christian imagery as opposed to just Hebrew imagery. It adds Christian imagery to them. Though, again, as we keep saying, if you read the Christian scriptures and know the Hebrew scriptures, there's a repetition of a whole lot of that us as Christians often miss, yeah, because we don't know the Hebrew.
But a lot of the Hebrew
traditions,
where they don't, a lot of them done orally. Mm-hmm. So these things could be.
They were songs. That's what psalms mean.
Off of
his songs, they were likely spoken or sung
right,
in church, or chanted, if not,
So they were familiar with the format.
Yeah. So what they did was take this format that they'd been using and add some new imagery. That make sense?
No, I knew what you were trying to say. I was just hit that it was really more than what you say
before, right? Okay. So then we have the three letters of John, and they're all part of the traditional New Testament as well. So the odes are an addition, but 1 John, 2 John, and 3 John all exist in the original New Testament, and they're all letters about avoiding false teachings. The first letter has.
So he probably shouldn't be in his class, actually.
The first letter is the longest and has a lot about. Actually, it's the one place in the Bible where it says God is love. Remember, we talked last week that how each of these letters, oftentimes, how like Hebrews. Obscure, not a lot of people know it, but it has that one sentence that defines faith that everybody knows. So like each one has a, well, this is the only place in the scriptures that actually says God is love.
In John.
It's the only,
first
yes,
John.
In 1 John.
In 1 John.
1 John, but in all of New Testament, it's and in all the New Testament, it's the only place that actually says God is love. And it says it in chapter 4, verse 7 and 8. Let us love one another because love comes from God. The person who does not love has not learned to know God, for God is love. So, I mean, now we say that all the time. You would think it was throughout the scriptures.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
It's that one place. I mean, it's implied in a lot of places, but it's the only place it actually says.
It's like that not being able to find a Christmas carol about love.
About love, right.
Love in it.
It's like... It's almost like you can't call the word because it's so integrated that they don't write about it being, you know, because it's just such a given, I guess. Though also the Hebrews wouldn't have necessarily defined God just as love. That was a whole lot of other things, you know, justice, just and redeemer, but also angry and power, you know. So it's Jesus brought that concept more than anyone else. He sort of took all of the Hebrew scriptures that pointed to that loving nature of God and really emphasized those. So,
if most of these three letters have to do with false teaching, how does that relate to God as love?
Well, that's what I'm saying. This first letter is the one that it sort of does both. It does a lot of teaching about God being love because who it's challenging is, and I was going to say there's sort of an interesting thing in here because it's saying you'll know us because we love one another, everything. And then it goes and slams these people who don't tend to agree with them and says they're liars. And I'm going, how is that universal love? It's sort of this interesting existence, you know, that what's wrong with them is that they don't love everybody. And so they're horrible, you know, and going, so, but
that's, love everybody or I will kill you.
Which is exactly what we see in traditional Christianity. So I felt like John 1, 1 John, and they think it was written by the same author who wrote John because the style and the verbiage is very similar. As they put it, of the Johns, one or another John, because they don't think it's the disciple John, but it's some John, or the followers of the disciple John. So they're pretty sure it was written in the 90s, thereabouts. So that's an early. He keeps sort of assuming that's a. He says the 90s for John. I've heard John could have been as late as 120.
Right.
So there's disagreement about when the Gospel of John and 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John were written.
Well, the fact is we don't know.
And we don't know. Well, yeah, all we do is
we don't have an original manuscript we can carbon date. We don't have anybody who kept a journal or a calendar on it. It's just we take historical clues and say, well, this guy Irenaeus mentioned this in one of the writers he wrote in 172, so it's clearly written before that. Let's call it 150.
Right. So that... It's all a guessing game, right?
And it doesn't matter at the end of the day, really, all that much.
Right.
I think I heard that, it's possible in the letter of John, I think, was written by Mary Magdalene.
Not.
Somebody
may say that, but same problem. Wasn't written until, 90. It would have been way after shit, and she wouldn't be alive any more than Jesus would have still, though... You know, they were imagining the Apostle John, who was supposed to be really young, still old, an old man writing this in late. But because
we had a tradition about John that he didn't die.
Right, that's true. They lived
on Isle
of
Patmos,
yes.
And he just stayed
there
forever.
Forever, yes.
Like Bubba G.
Like we could still go find him. So the point, the false teaching that the First John is talking about, one theory is that it's the Gnostics, in the sense, they call Gnostics, you know, that gets a label, but it was those who were teaching that there was a secret teaching, and so some of us are better than others, only those who get the secret teaching. And this author is saying, no, we're supposed to all love each other, and anybody who's teaching that they're special elite folks and that have it better or higher or whatever are not getting the teaching, the real teaching, because we're taught to love one another, and that's the sign, not that you have this special teaching or special awareness of Jesus' teachings, but the fact that you got the message that we're supposed to love each other. So that's the dynamic of that letter. And he writes, it's not in the format of a letter, the traditional format of a letter, and he repeats himself, just like Revelation repeats itself over and over. He goes through various times. That I found the most interesting thing that you could talk about, that we have to love each other. And then he says, who is a liar if not the person who rejects the truth that Jesus is the Christ? Yeah, so it's an interesting dynamic that goes on. But there is a ton of language about the relationship between God loving people and people loving each other. And this guy says it's almost as ecstatic as the gospel of truth. And it's in very harsh conflict with then how he attacks the Antichrist. It's also one of two books that the term Antichrist is used. 1st and 2nd John are the only places that Antichrist. And it's interesting, I realized that I had to take the energy off of the word. When we think of Antichrist, we think of it now with the generations of literally millennium of meaning, and now, you know, the sign of the 666 and the Antichrist is like the devil. He's really talking about people who were Antichrist. And so that term gets then turned into something way, because there's multiple Antichrists, and they're the ones that are teaching something different. And we've turned that into
Yeah, because when I wrote it down, I was thinking like that.
I know. As I was reading, I'm going, oh, he's just identifying people who are anti-Christ. He's not identifying Satan.
Capital A, capital C. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. So that's 1 John. 2 John is anti-docetism, and it actually is a letter from the elder addressed to the lady. It's also in a very similar language, so they think it was of the same school, if not the same writer, likely written about the same time. But here, the Antichrist teaching is anyone who doesn't accept or acknowledge that Jesus as Christ came in the flesh. They if they teach it, he was always spirit. He was never actually a physical being, and that's Docetism. And so it was attacking that the people that taught that idea. Docetism. D-O-C-E-T-I-S-M.
Docetism. Nope. D-O-C-E-T-I-S-M.
And what is that?
It's the idea that Jesus never actually came in the flesh, that the Christ is just a spirit. Not just, but...
Already they were saying.
So, yeah, there was this thing that because if it was God, he couldn't have been crucified. You know, it's how people process. He couldn't have been the same as the Muslims.
Couldn't have been present in the physical, or he couldn't have resurrected.
Right, one or the other. So
it's got to be one of the
other. So actually, he was spirit. And that's a...
This was only 60 years after his death.
That's an... Well, sure. But
Before that, actually.
Yeah, because they're debating it. It's everybody trying to make sense of this event. And so...
Docetism is Christ was spirit, not human.
What? Huh? Yep. So Jesus was actually just a spirit being.
Oh, is that what we accept as the truth?
No. That was considered an Antichrist teaching.
An Antichrist. It's a heresy. It still is.
Okay.
And so this letter was warning against that. You know. And the third John is even briefer and even more obscure, also written by the elder. But what I found in the Unity stuff is metaphysically, Gaius, who was a recipient of the letter, is something more about the physical body also. The acceptance by the body consciousness. So, as I understand it, this author is teaching that we believe that the body can be redeemed. And the Antichrist, in these cases, we're saying that it's all a spiritual thing and the body has to be left behind. And they were saying that's an Antichrist teaching. That, in fact, what the traditional thing is that the body will also be redeemed. So those were the three Antichrist teachings that these three letters were addressing.
Silly humans, huh? All this
pollution. You can't coincide it. You cannot line that up with reincarnation. It's an interesting discussion today. I mean, I have a lot of friends who are relatively thoughtful Christian thinkers who will say, so if you're resurrected, if you believe you're resurrected and reunited with Jesus at some point down the road, whatever that happens, does your body go with you or not? If it's not true, if your body doesn't go with you, then how does anybody recognize you? I mean, what are the markers? What are the things that make you? And the body, a big thing that makes you, of course, they're lost in this whole dualism thing, but the fact is that if you live in a dualistic world and your mind is dualistic, that is a legitimate question to raise. It's not just, it seems silly to us, but it really isn't.
That seems silly.
For me, as I interpret this, in terms of the body being redeemed, means that I can experience heaven on earth even in the body. It doesn't mean that this physical body is somehow redeemed and eternal. It means that we can experience the realm of consciousness even while we have bodies. We don't have to die and go to heaven. We can bring heaven right here. So that's how I interpret the redemption of the body. It means that the physical isn't other.
What are the...
Profane.
I'd still buy the doctrine of redemption of the body. So.
These be like, you know, sometimes somebody went through some... books that laying around, and he found some letters, and you know, saying, "Hey, I'm glad you're with me and speaking the truth, and good job, and this guy's doing all right too." And I just feel, I mean, I know this sounds stupid, but what is like the significance of these?
That they were included.
They were widespread. They were read by lots of Christians, and
they
thought
it feels
these
like they're still, you know, like I wrote you a letter, and you know.
But there's teachings in all of them.
But I could, yeah. And I've written letters that I suppose.
But the church, so you got to remember, the church, they got all these things, all these documents, all these letters, all these gospels, all the whatever, and they that had been going around to the various churches. Now, literally, they're physical. They're not sent by internet or anything, so they're physical. And this body said, okay, we got to figure out which one of these we're going to canonize. And as they came to these three, my guess is they've got included because they taught a specific thing about what was Antichrist, and they agreed with these teachings, these three teachings. The canon people agreed that Jesus was body, physical, and spirit, that it isn't a special secret knowledge, that it's, you know, so they included these because they hit on those three principles, which were still issues being dealt with in the churches in 300 when the body came together to meet.
Oh, not even close.
Oh, no. They just chose documents that to include in this. Yeah, they didn't include all of them. Right. And they did a very similar thing. He created a council of learned people and said, so in 2014 or whenever it came out, what do we think? Which ones of these new ones we discovered, now that we know more of what's going on, we've had 2,000 years, what else would be helpful? And they voted just like they did in the... In the
it's not like
Nicene
they thought
Council.
It was going to become what it became, right? I mean, when they put all the canon together, was it going to be the? Was it the Word of God?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, and they were under. That was part of the cooperation with Constantine and the Roman Empire.
Right.
Was to come up with a book that's your doctrine.
That's
right.
Your doctrine. Okay.
Right.
So they were trying to bring it all together and say this is the way it is. That's why they got rid of all that other stuff.
And again,
right.
Many of them now were talking that. I mean, they can't deny the connection to. Like he calls it the followers of Israel, as opposed to saying Hebrew teachings or whatever. But so he uses a different language. But many of them came from Paul and had been Gentiles and had no real understanding of the Hebrew scriptures, other than that it gets quoted sometimes. And that shows up in our Christianity, that we read the Old Testament, but we really have no foundational understanding of Old Testament and how it relates. In other words, traditional Christianity teaches that the Old Testament actually was predicting Jesus' coming. I mean, that's how we all grew up and believed it, right? That it was right in there. And so those scriptures I read at Advent were actually predicting Jesus. No, it was written the other way around. The people writing about Jesus went back and found scriptures that sounded like their experience and brought them forward. But Christianity teaches that the New Testament's the fulfillment of the Old Testament, and it was being predicted all the way through.
We teachers call that backward mapping.
Yes.
Is
there also the assumption that Jesus himself was so sensitive to the Old to what we call the Old Testament, that he himself behaved in ways that were consistent
because he was I would say he used similar imagery to do his teachings.
Because he was steeped in it, probably.
Right, like I read on Sunday.
That's what he knew.
Second hour, remember I talked about the prophet.
He just taught it, probably. He's a Jew.
Blanking on his name right now. But remember I read the prophet.
Khalil Gibran?
No. A Hebrew prophet.
Oh.
On Sunday, and I read the scripture, and he talks about the world being raised up on the third day.
Jeremiah?
No, it wasn't Jeremiah.
One of the minor prophets, as I recall.
It was one of the minor prophets who
it wasn't the Italian prophet Malachi.
It was the one that was having them go back to build. Anyway, but the language in it is like on the third day we'll be raised up. I mean, the imagery is very similar to Jesus, and so Jesus may have used some of that language when he talked about, you know, things are going to be destroyed and be raised up. I mean, teachers now sometimes say, well, none of that, Jesus may not have used any of that language. Other people went back to find things that described him, but I would think, having read that, I didn't know it was even in that prophet, that Jesus could have used that as a symbol to say, yeah, we're going to transform things and use similar.
He was repeating
the prophecies.
He said the temple would be destroyed and rebuilt. That could even be about his
Well, that's what it, that's what they made it be about, his death, you know, to raise up. But that's, you know, so that, but the scriptures before. It's just the idea is you got to remember that those scriptures weren't predicting this happening, but as things happen, we go back and make sense out of it by what's happened in the past.
Hindsight insights.
Like, oh, that's like when that happened. That doesn't mean that that was predicting this would happen, but we made sense out of it by looking back at history, at our stories, at, you know, it's like now when we hear a story of redemption, we relate it to our Christian roots oftentimes. Well, that's just like, you know, so they did the same thing. They were relating it to the prophets of old.
So it really, there's no connection. I mean, it's just how you're saying. It's not that they have...
There's connection. There's no prediction.
There's no prediction.
There's no prediction.
Yeah.
Right. That's, the Hebrew scriptures did not predict Jesus.
Uh-huh. That's really good to know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, they were hoping for a Messiah. Mm-hmm. especially in the Apocrypha, the time in between, they were hoping for a Messiah. They were talking about a Messiah. There would be Psalms that God's going to send a Redeemer, but they were meaning a political Redeemer that was going to literally come and make them a nation again and make their lives here on earth different.
Mm-hmm. That's what basically Jews.
Well, there also seems to be.
Not what I had in mind.
That's right. Yeah. Or to say, I need to push you a little bit and get you to, you know, you need to reveal things.
For some reason, he had a whole different idea.
Yep. So what it...
But there also seems to be an argument for the dreaming body, or as the sorcerers experienced, that was a replica, but not physical, an unphysical replica of a real body that was, in their experience, was indistinguishable. So there's a factor there, too, that kind of relates to the idea that, you know, where was his physicality?
Right.
It's very complicated.
Well, and then you have the tenth insight that was talking about, that existence is a vibration. And so that would be counter to, I would think that's counter to reincarnation, because it says we just continue to exist and we can lower our vibration and become visible or raise it. So even if we've died, we've just become invisible as opposed to...
That's consistent with the Hindu traditions in the Vedas about the way they'll talk about reincarnation, talk about transmigration, but similar idea.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Transmigration works a little better with that concern.
See, and what Unity would say is the Christ signature is present, but it's present in all of us.
But that we also maybe each have our own unique signature that gets, maybe that's how we recognize each other.
I think I understand what you're saying.
Well, and if you come to, there's only one of us here, it's sort of like we recognize each other.
You would have heard that before.
Because, you know, there's a recognition.
Yeah.
But I wonder if the Catholic doctrine of no cremation, which I never read.
Well, yeah, that used to be because you would be reunited with the body. Yeah, right. That's what that was all about. And we were talking about that last week and saying, so that doesn't account for that. How do you get all those cells back from the intestines of the worms and everything? I mean, you know, the same thing happens whether or not you cremate or not, you know. Yeah. So it still all turns to dust. What, it just takes longer one way than it does the other.
They even say it turns to dust.
Yes. So.
Well, it affects certainly our standard of behavior in dealing with the body. The Hebrews still insist on within 3 days it goes in the ground, right? And Catholics still insist that they don't cremate.
They stopped that, actually.
More recently,
they've moved away from that. That at some level, they aren't.
It's because they're just running out of cemetery rooms.
Yeah. Well,
it's just practicality. Right,
a lot of it becomes practicality, yeah. And then they have to revisit the. So is this really true? And now they understand that the body, disintegrates in the earth. And I mean, you know, we could bring science into it, and you get a different interpretation.
I don't know if it's Hindu or I think I heard Deepak Chopra talk about it or something, that died and they chopped up his body, because it's symbolism of that you are not your body. So.
Right. That's Buddhist, isn't it? It's Tibetan. It's Tibetan. Wow. Tibetan, where they chop it up and the birds, and they up on top of a mountain, and the birds come and take the parts.
And Native right. American did very similar things. They
we'll put you on a pyre, but that, they often burned that.
Yeah. Well, oftentimes, yeah. But not always.
But yeah, we have all kinds of rituals with our body. Yeah.
I've never heard chopping it up and leave it to the
body. Oh, chopping it up and leave it?
I've never
Well. Chop it up, meaning they cut it into pieces. Yes, and it's a very sacred ritual to cut the body. It isn't like a axsaw murder. It's a.
It would probably break up our attachment to the body if we saw that done with some of our family members or something.
Okay, we got to get back, or we're not going to get through any of this. All right, so those are the three letters, and then there's the revelation to John. And as I said, this is all written in the tradition of John, though not. Scholars now don't believe it was the disciple John writing these, but
is this like the book of Revelations that everybody talks about?
Yes,
it's Revelation.
Revelation singular.
Revelation to John.
Yes, that's the book that you're that everybody talks about and quotes. Revelation to John, and we call it Revelations, which is not right.
Which
it's Revelation, right?
Revelation.
It's unique in tone and shape from anything else in the New Testament or the New Testament. In fact, there's still disagreement as to whether or not it should have been included by
remember, Martin Luther said it didn't belong there.
Right.
Luther said it didn't belong
there? Right.
Yeah. It did not.
This is at the time when they were putting it all together?
Well, the 1500s old.
Luther
after that.
In 1500.
The Reformation.
Remembered when that Protestant Reformation, when he started having it, the Bible should be in different in the vernacular so that people could read it and such. So
he suggested leaving out four books in the New Testament. That was one of them.
So, so what's your sense of Revelation? What do you think when?
Apocalyptic, end of the world, gonna blow up. And I haven't read it.
Which is why we all avoid it and don't want to read it, right?
And then it's far out and hard to understand.
It's very symbolic, yes. So it seldom talks about Jesus, but it refers to the living one, or the first and the last, or the lamb, or the warrior. It was likely written again about the same time as the Gospel, according to this scholar. And I guess it would be written about the same time, whether it was
like 90,
whether it's between 90 and 120. He says 90, but it doesn't have a similar style to John. It doesn't have a similar style to anything. They suspect. I mean, the theory says that John went to the island of Patmos and he had this vision and wrote Revelation based on the vision. They have more of it. Like, it seems like it was probably written in multiple locations. No, actually,
really
there you go.
What it seems like.
Yes, but what you need, again, we don't know the Hebrew scriptures, because like 50% of it was taken from the book of Daniel.
Really?
And other parts were taken from Ezekiel and other parts from Zechariah, and the images are very similar to those books. So they're taking them, and in those books, they were writing about... in Daniel, writing about Greece being this dominating force, and that's the when Greece was taken over, it's the story where we get Hanukkah from, right? Where they came in and they desecrated the temple, and Antiochus, whatever was the Greek ruler, you know, they divided. What happened is they divided up the empire when the last Caesar died. They divided it into three, and the three lieutenants each got a section, and the one who got Judah was just a total jerk, and the Maccabees defeat him, and Israel's actually independent for 100 years until the Romans come along, and so they're going through a very similar thing to what's happening when this is being written, except now it's Rome instead of Greece who's dominating them and such. So they use very similar language. When they wrote those kinds of things, they couldn't talk about the country that. Who was really in charge of them, so they always made it a previous one. So, and he talks about Babylon, because 600 years before, Babylon was who came and destroyed the first temple, the Temple of Solomon, and scattered the Jews all over the, you know, that was the exile, and sent them all over and such. So they, when they know, when they talk about Babylon, other Jews are going to know, oh, you mean the evil empire that's now trying to, that Emperor Rome had just destroyed the temple in 65. So it's being written in 90 to 100. 30 years earlier, Rome had destroyed the temple. So all the Jews would know what he's referring to, but they can't write it that way. So it presents like it's a play as opposed to a political document, or they can try and hide behind it. So apocalyptic means, we all think it sort of implies an end time, but it really means to uncover or reveal, which is why we call Revelation, right? The Apocrypha, we've talked about, is that section in the Bible that was left out of the Protestant Bibles. And so then when it was included, it's the hidden part, right, that's now being revealed. Why we called it the Apocrypha, because it was hidden and now is being revealed.
The apocalypse is, really means what?
To reveal.
To reveal?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
And it talks about end of an age. It's not the end of, it's not the end of time. It's just like the Mayan calendar time was going to end. No, it's just the end of an age, and you end the age so a new age can come. So the book of Revelation is to the New Testament what the book of Daniel was to the Hebrew Scriptures. This will be an interesting way to do this. I found this description in a Unity teaching metaphysics of this. So he says the bulk of the drama, he does this whole introduction of welcome to our play. You know, I'm going to give you a little overview of what's going to happen so you know how it's going. And remember that all of this is about you yourself as much as the world, because we're all, and it's actually the journey of redemption. It's the journey of how we finally arrive at enlightenment, or for them, they would talk about more as a Christian thing, how the end's going to come about. And we have to suffer oftentimes before that happens, right? So he said it's broken into seven episodes. Episode one describes the opening of seven letters to seven churches in Asia Minor. And each of these letters seems to describe the benefits and weaknesses of different states of thinking. These states seem to be desire, abundance, intellectualism, zealousness, power, love, and deciding. The author cautions what can happen when we enter into these states from sense awareness. So that's the metaphysics of what happens in Revelations chapters 1, 2, and 3, where he's writing to John, and he's using very descriptive language, but they're talking about it here. So episode 2, and in the actual writing, the first couple of chapters are the invitation to John, and they're taking him to Patmos and giving him this vision of how the world will unfold. And so that's the metaphysics of it. Episode 2 begins with the author being transported to heaven. So the vision begins. He then describes a vision of opening seven seals. And each of these seals describes what often happens as the soul is being transformed from mortal consciousness to spiritual consciousness. So the first four seals, if you're familiar at all with Revelation, are the four horses. I mean, we've probably heard of the four horses of the apocalypse. First comes out is the white horse. Second one that comes out is the red horse. The third one that comes out is the black horse. And the fourth one is the pale horse. Matthew Fox is, I mean, now I don't know if it was Matthew Fox or Emmett Fox. It's Emmett Fox suggested that the white horse represents our spiritual nature. The red horse represents our emotional nature, the black horse our intellectual nature, and the pale horse our physical nature. And so when we ride on the spiritual, our spiritual nature, that's when we win, we overcome. And in the Revelation, the white horse, of course, is the one that Jesus is riding on and overcomes. But when we give in to our emotions or our intellect or our physical nature, we can get out of balance. And it really represents the destruction of the world through war and pestilence, or the destruction of ourselves when we allow those other natures to take charge in our lives.
I've kind of lost the connection with John.
The only reason it's John is because it says it's a revelation to John. There's nothing else that suggests it's not in the same style as the other things, but it's always the history of it.
It's written
Yes, these are what happens in the Book of Revelation. Is the John has a vision, and in his vision there's these seven seals that open. The first four are these horses that ride out. Actually, what they say is writers after that, but before the canonization, separated John the disciple, the beloved one, from John the revealer. They wrote about them as two different people. So they think that supports that it wasn't John the disciple, but you know how people like to, it gives it more authority if it was John the disciple.
Mary and John, right? And Joseph.
So the first four seals, the horses, seem to tell us something about strong beliefs, one of which is the Christ, symbolized by the rider on the white horse. But watch out for the other three, because they represent belief in war, lack, and death. As we'll see, spiritual transformation can be difficult, and some of these scenes contain really disturbing images. Again, most of the scenes come from Daniel, and the same kinds of descriptions of Daniel. The fifth seal describes the suffering we experience when we buy into these ideas of war, lack, and death, and it continues with an earthquake in the sixth seal, which represents our mind being in turmoil. So the fifth seal, in actual of what's writing about, is it has these souls come out from underneath a table, and they're asking, so when is Christ going to come? They're the souls that have died, that they were the faithful, but they died before Christ came, and they said, when's Christ going to actually come? And the voice says, well, you got to go back for a little while, because there's going to be more martyrs, and then when the time is right, then you'll all be lifted up. So that's what happens in the fifth seal. The sixth seal, again, is the earthquake and such, which represents great universal disorder. So it was acts of God, meaning that this isn't just about the earth. This transformation is going to affect the whole universe. It's going to make the sun turn black and the moon turn red, and there's going to be earthquakes and such, which implies that it goes beyond just here. So then the third episode happens, and it describes what happens when the seventh seal is broken. And in Revelation, it's like he repeats himself. It's like a teacher who says, you know, makes his point, which he does with those seven, and then he makes it again. And the seventh one of each one opens up seven more, which he basically goes back and repeats the same issues. In the seventh seal, there's like a half an hour of silence after earthquakes and all kinds of stuff happening. And then there are seven angels sounding their trumpets. So now he's going to go through seven more. The Bible teacher from Unity suggests you could imagine that the seven seals represent seven denials. You know, we do denials and affirmations. So it's like we deny the power of these things. And the seven angels and trumpets are like seven affirmations. So you deny the all the earthly stuff, and then you affirm the truth. So each one of the angels comes for symbolizing the advance of spiritual development. So each one of us, so those become the affirmations. While much of this imagery appears destructive, try to remember that it's really a cleansing process of destroying that which is false in us. And this author says, I'll leave it to you to figure out what false beliefs you may be holding that need to be destroyed or released. But let me give a preview of some of the images that show up. Hail and fire, a great mountain thrown into the sea, a star falling into the rivers and poisoning the water, and the sun and the moon going dark. Says worst things take place in our own mind, if you think about it. So, sort of using that. Let go of these false ideas. Letting go of these false ideas takes time and can be painful. But by the time the seventh trumpet is sounded, we are coming into a real transformation. So if you start reading it from this just really symbolic, amazing story about how we as individuals and we as a humanity have to, what we have to let go of and such, and it starts to takes on a different orientation. Episode 4 describes another point of view of our spiritual unfolding, but this time it's described in three stages instead of seven. First is the birth of the Christ child, represented by a woman clothed with the sun, the moon under her feet, and upon her head a crown of 12 stars, who is about to give birth to the Christ child. So 12 is, you know, the 12 tribes, the 12 disciples. It's spiritual completion. Next is the resistance we put up in the form of the Antichrist or negative teachings. It's like, so we're confronted with the truth, and then our minds go, yeah, but what about, but what about, but what about? And so that's the second stage, which is portrayed by the great red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns who threatened to devour the Christ child. But even evil can only threaten good. It can never actually harm the Christ child. In the end, both the woman and the Christ child are safe, which means that regardless of any threat, our soul is always protected. Episode 5 is a warning to all of us who have achieved spiritual maturity to not be too complacent. Even though we have become mature, we do not yet have final victory, and there will be 7 things that continue to plague us if we don't keep vigilant. Again, 7. There's. Our presenter will describe in this episode how we draw to ourselves spiritual tests to strengthen our desire to know God. So if you become mature, it's going to say, but there's, doesn't mean you're there. There's still going to be these things going on.
Makes you can't wait for life to develop.
These tests may seem like God's wrath and appear like a series of plagues, but they're actually for our own benefit. Episode 6 describes the beginning of the final victory of Christ as a rider on a white horse. The rider overthrows Rome as symbolized by a beast and the whore of Babylon. Do you know what's cool? I just cut and pasted this and read through it. Nero, who is the one who killed Paul and was, you know, killing all the, having all the Christians go in with the lions and all that kind of thing, is the beast. And the whore of Babylon is Rome. And so the episode continues by describing the 1,000-year reign, once they're defeated, 1,000-year reign of peace for those loved ones of ours who have already died. These 1,000 years are what commonly are referred to as the millennium, honors those who remain faithful but never lived to see Jesus coming back as promised. Episode 7 portrays the final triumph of Christ by describing the new heaven and the new earth, a place and time where God will wipe away every tear from our eyes and death will be no more. The interesting thing is it's on earth. In Revelation, the new Jerusalem comes out of the sky into earth, and God lives on the earth with humanity constantly. So it goes back to the, how it was with Abraham. And at the conclusion, we will hear a few final words from Jesus, a few final warnings about the need to stay focused and faithful. He'll warn us that our job is to stay vigilant and not to be trying to use these prophecies to our own advantage. So that's the metaphysics of Revelation.
Use these prophecies. Ba-bum-bum.
Ba-bum-bum. Yeah, so don't use them to control people. He has it in here, and I took it out as I was going through, and he's going, I think he threw that in just for those televangelists. Give them something to preach about and confuse them.
You took all that out?
Well, I just put it, I just said it. I just took that sentence out.
One of the things that Andy Henry kept mentioning in the course that I took was that no matter what level you get to, you're still, there's temptations. And,
yep.
And you're going to make worse mistakes the higher up you go.
Well, the higher you go, the bigger the fall is, or the bigger the risk is. And it's also, if you think about the temptations of Jesus, it's like the temptation is you have this power. You could rule the whole world if you use this power. So you get the higher you go, the temptation gets huger. And I would think the most powerful one is you think you're doing it for the good of humanity. We could just, you know, we take away people's freedom. I mean, the higher you go, if you can...
I mean, I think the higher you go, do you mean the higher in consciousness?
I say the higher in consciousness, the temptation is you think you could rule the world.
You can, yeah.
So that becomes the temptation. I can use these.
You're going higher, though, if you think.
Right, because you're using the power for, you think you're using the power for good. So there's always this temptation that, well, I know better than everybody else now, and I could do it for you, which defeats the point. So that's the point of why the higher you get, there's still temptations.
Yeah, we won't mention
true.
We won't talk
yes.
In your own way.
A quick question.
I think I know better than you.
Yes, like parents. She's saying we do that as parents, right? We think we know better than our kids. So.
You said quickly about the middle of all this that the canon agreed on 3 things. And you said, and that was right about the time you were speaking of Jesus was body. That was one of the first things.
Okay, so the first 3 letters of John. The canon agreed with the teachings of the first 3 letters, the first one being that there was no secret teaching.
No secret teaching. Okay.
The second one being that Jesus actually was physical.
Right.
And the third one being that the body can be redeemed. The physical body can be redeemed.
Thank you.
That there isn't a sacred and profane, that in fact when the...
That still seems a bit of a mystery to me.
That's a big part of Catholicism, right?
Yeah.
The body's going to be raised up.
Right. I mean, then we interpret that in all kinds of ways. Like what I said, I believe the body being redeemed means that it's not profane, that it means that I can, in body, still achieve the consciousness of bringing heaven forth on earth. That's one way of interpreting what it means to have the body be redeemed, because the counter teaching is the body is profane and there's no way in body you can achieve the spiritual awareness. And I'm saying, well, we can bring our body... our body doesn't have to be profane.
Well, what if our bodies actually can have self-sacrifice?
Well, yeah, I believe they do. Well, I believe that as long as you align it, as long as you don't let your body rule,
like
so you go after your sense consciousness. Yeah, because our bodies have wisdom if we listen. So.
What did you say?
Not like Puritan beliefs that, you know, like sex is bad or whatever.
Right,
whatever,
right.
Drinking and, you know.
But I think the enlightenment has nothing, or the realization has nothing to do with the body so much as when we... This is how I would explain it now. When we come to realize some things, we use our body more for love than the lust and the desire and all that. So our body is a tool.
Right.
The body itself is the body.
That's right.
I mean, it's something that's dust and clay and...
Mostly air and water.
Right. It is what it is. It's a tool.
Right.
That's how I see it. So
right. But see, this teaching would have said that the body is like almost basically evil, that you have to you have to put down the body.
Right.
And what I'm saying is this teaching could also mean, doesn't have to mean that we have to not ever destroy our body because it will be redeemed with us, which goes to the other extreme. But there's nothing wrong with the body. It's just a tool, you can
really
use it.
It's really a neutral thing.
Yes.
It's not saying that the body will reappear after death physically?
Well, that's one interpretation. That's an interpretation the Catholic Church took, which is why...
The physical body is just a dreaming body.
Right.
They're saying the physical body will rise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's a spectrum of that teaching. There's a spectrum of how you could interpret it.
And that's what we will fight over, though.
Yes,
right?
That's what we argue over. Right, but the reason they included it in the canon was because those three basic teachings were aligning with what they were trying to teach. So
that was a then.
Yes. Yeah, not necessarily a now. Though what we do now is we just interpret it differently. Yeah. We go around it. Well, it's all for interpretation anyway. Who knows what they meant when they wrote it? So now we're to the final book. Yeah, which interpretation, which language, which translation, which... The final book is the new one that they included. The secret revelation of John.
And that's really what it's called?
Yes.
Well, name it that.
Well, it's called the Apocryphon of John.
Which means secret,
but the
hidden.
Apocrypha means hidden.
And that's how they found it?
That's how they found it, when it was found.
And
that's what
it's called,
you're
going to say when they found it, right?
Oh, yeah.
No, but they...
What was the title?
Secret Revelation.
Okay.
I have to say from all this, without having read, I haven't read it. I just read the introduction, you know? But I love the companion piece.
Yeah.
Yes.
I have such a different feel for those early times.
Yeah.
You know, well, I have some feeling, because before I didn't really have any, you know. Yeah, it's interesting that way.
Yep.
You know, how those people were, or maybe, or something. You know?
Well, it also brings something to put these scriptures in that time and what they were experienced, where we've grown up in church with the scriptures are just... They're timeless and they're God speaking to us, right? I mean, we take them out of context, and it helps to put them back in context.
Yes.
Doesn't mean there isn't wisdom for us, but it's very different than saying it was written for us today as opposed to it was written 2,000 years ago.
And I like the idea, and I think I agree with them, that there should be discussion about.
Yes.
The discussion is healthy.
Again, in the tradition of Judaism, that was a given.
Yes, I think that's a wonderful
thing. That was a given, that you would take a scripture and you would debate what that line meant, all the different ways, how was God speaking to us and such. And see, that's something else we lost with the Gentile Roman, this becomes the word. Nobody can challenge it. Only the priests can interpret it. In fact, it would be used in the way that would support the kingdom. So.
Well, is there any evidence that the people who were discussing it had enough of the feminine, the divine feminine in there? By that, I mean not just logic and intellect, but also intuition and...
You mean the Jews?
Speaking...
I think it would probably be as much as the individuals. Some of them had to develop feminine. There was a Sophia, there was a wisdom, there was a feminine aspect of God.
So it was functional.
But you would probably have macho guys that looked more at the male and some that looked more balanced.
One of the things that I kind of learned in the process of looking at this book and other things is, I guess I always kind of had the 12 apostles up on a pedestal.
No.
I mean, you know, it's just...
That's what we were taught.
And in looking at all of this stuff, it's like they were arguing against the divine feminine.
Yes.
Even from the very beginning, I'm like, what?
Yeah.
Guys.
Yeah. No, they didn't have it at all necessarily.
They were,
you know, they say, I've said this before in this class, with people around teachers, how many groups you've connected into, but I've been in a couple different groups, and it's like, the word out there is that people who are closest to the teacher really aren't getting it at all.
No.
They're the ones that are clinging to the master, and they like want to be part of it and want to be, you know. But the people who are really practicing it don't need to be right next to the teacher, you know. It's an interesting thing to think about.
Well, that's always been my idea about why Jesus left. Was like, you guys aren't getting
it.
You're making it about me.
So
you're not
get
about
out of
me.
Here. That's interesting.
All right, Dan.
I keep having to restart your, reopen your phone because you got it set to go dark screen every 15 seconds.
Oh, yeah, you can set it to be.
No, you could set it to be. I'm going to change the settings on your phone. But.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, otherwise, what I do is I keep my finger on it. Okay, let's see.
Don't worry about it. I'll figure it out. I mean, I'll use it without it.
Hold on.
Just as before you start, setting. Giants officially signed Cueto.
Yeah, I knew they would.
Yeah, they did.
Yeah.
Okay, active display.
The Giants signed him.
Yeah. I never used them.
Yeah, they officially signed him.
I guess.
Display.
I don't know where to find it.
The Giants baseball. They signed a new pitcher. I'm sure
they
took an MRI of his elbow.
Of
his
elbow.
Yeah.
Give it more time, that's all.
Must be okay.
Yeah.
Just remind me to go back and change that back.
5 year, 6 year contract.
Now you got to get back into.
$40 million a year or something.
Well, it's kind of like.
That's not what you wanted.
Million. Nope.
What's his name?
Is it? It's in here. There you go.
I can't think of his name right now.
Elbow?
Okay.
Oh,
so now you should at least have 10 minutes before it goes down. And if you just touch it, it'll keep expanding it.
So, okay.
All right. So the last book we're going to cover is called The Secret Revolution of John, or as I said earlier, The Apocryphon of John. The earliest copy of this particular manuscript appeared on European antiquities markets in the end of the 19th century, or in 1896. And a German scholar had bought it from some travelers in the Middle East and brought it back to the antiquities market to sell. And there are a lot of stories about what happened to them in the meantime when they were trying to get it translated, some of which parallel some of the things we talked about other manuscripts, in part because this Secret Revolution of John was part of a four-book codice. So there are four different books in this manuscript, and this is just one of them.
And we don't have the others?
Yeah, we know. The Sophia, the Epistles of Sophia is one of them. The letter to the Apostle of Peter was one. I can't remember the other one. Oh, maybe the Gospel of Mary Magdalene was the other one. So in 1945, Nag Hammadi gets discovered, and that cache yielded another three copies of this book. They're all, of course, badly damaged, and all four were written in Coptic, which, as you know, is the Egyptian alphabet transliterated into Greek letters with some other ones added on because the Greek didn't support. Modern scholars working on this book tend to work with the first copy, the one that was discovered or uncovered in the 1890s, which is called the Berlin Codex. And they supplement that where the three Nag Hammadi manuscripts supply pieces that are missing in that original document. Authorship unknown, but certainly wasn't John the disciple. Written around 150 CE, although that's essentially a guess, based on references to it in the writings of early church fathers. The first published copy of this particular manuscript was a German translation, and it didn't come about until 1955. And not until 1996 did we have a solid English translation. But it was remarkable work that combined all four of the existing copies with a deeply analytical commentary. But if you're into this book, that's one thing you're going to do. So this is one of the most important books. It's hard sometimes, and I read a number of other articles, and it's hard sometimes to understand, unless you put it in the political context, why this book wouldn't have made it into the canon, because it's got a lot of features that don't show up anywhere else. Karen King, who wrote a whole book on this book, said this is the first writing to formulate a comprehensive narrative of Christian theology, cosmology, and salvation. So it's like the whole Megillah in one book, a fairly short book. We had the story of creation from the Jewish scriptures, the Hebrew scriptures, from the Jewish historical perspective. We didn't have an explanation of the creation or of the creation of man or the nature of man or the nature of God in any Christian documents. We just adopted pieces piecemeal from the Hebrew scriptures. This book is an attempt, however strange it may seem sometimes, to provide a Christian explanation of those really important subjects, and it does it in a way that's really different in many ways from what we have in Genesis. Hal Taussig, who edited this volume, says, before it, no Christian writing had told the whole story of creation and salvation from beginning to end. So this was a book that has a lot of meat in it. So you can see this book is divided into two sections, although one of them's huge and the other one's not. The first 23 chapters or so, 24 chapters or so, depending on how you break it out, are Jesus narrating a story, and I'll explain that. And the second part is John asking questions and getting answers. So the creation story that unfolds in the first part of the secret revelation to John follows in some ways, at least in broad outline, the story of creation in Genesis. It has a lot of differences, but the general flow is sort of similar. It also shows a lot of evidence of influence from the Jewish wisdom literature and from apocalyptic writings at the time. And yet, one of the distinguishing characteristics of this manuscript is that it is extremely critical of God. That is, of the Jewish creator God, of Yahweh, or however, whatever name you wish to attach to him, who in the Hebrew world, of course, is the only God. He is that God. That is, there's no other God before me and all that sort of stuff, right? It's difficult to say whether these teachings that we're going to get into a little bit here are the product of disaffected Jews who helped co-author this thing with the idea of they've been already broken off from the Jewish community. Probably they've been ostracized because of their following of Jesus as the Savior and so on. Whether this is their writing trying to say, well, see, you guys got it all wrong. This God isn't the God you think he is, and here's why. Or whether those came out of Christian thought, original Christian thought and conversation. So we don't know. We don't know the answer to that question. One of the things that's key in this text, and it's one that we don't get a lot of opportunity to understand or study very well, is what's called a theogony. Theogony. And this book contains a classically Greco-Roman theogony, which is an account of the generation of the divine realm. How did all this come to be? A philosophical answer to the questions of creation and the problem of evil. We've talked about the problem of evil a number of times in this class. The problem of evil asks the question, how could a perfect, good, loving God create a world with as much garbage and hate and violence as we have? How could that come about? How could God, even know about the a way of creating something so abhorrent and evil. It shouldn't fit into his mental structures. It shouldn't be part of his awareness. It just shouldn't be possible. So the book is going to provide an answer to that question, which you're going to find quite interesting and a little over the top. So here's Karen King wrote the book this year, as I told you, has a whole like 8 or 9 paragraph narration of the story, which I of course don't have with me, so I'm gonna follow along from what Tosig offers, but it's very similar. So here's how the story begins. John is out on his way to the temple, and he runs into a Pharisee. And the Pharisee says to him, "What happened to this God of yours? He's not around anywhere." And he says, "Oh, he died, he's coming back." And the Pharisee offers a serious sort of challenge to John, which he says, "This Nazarene deceived you with error. He filled your ears with lies and he shut your hearts. He turned you from the traditions of your fathers." And when John says, "When I heard these things, I turned from the temple to the mountain," which was a place of desert, "and I grieved greatly in my heart." So that's how the story starts. John is on his way to the temple to worship. This Pharisee comes along and says, "Man, you've been really duped. This so-called God you got, where is he? Is he around anywhere? Did he abandon you? Made you give up the faith of your fathers? Change all your belief systems? And what do you got to show for it, basically?" And John's really bothered by that. So then he decides, instead of going to the temple, he'll go off into the wilderness. So he goes out in the wilderness, and Jesus appears. This is a huge vision, similar to the revelation to John that we just talked about a few minutes ago. And that the sky lights up and Jesus shows up. And he shows up in several different forms and personas in the course of the story. And basically he says that it's that the way the whole world, the whole universe and everything in the cosmos and humanity came into being is through this process that is amazingly complex and intricate. Nothing at all like Genesis. So Genesis has a pretty straightforward creation story. God creates man, creates animals and plants, as it creates man, end of story. Basically, there's nothing beyond that in terms of the creation account. But in this particular secret revelation, what we hear is something really significantly different and quite bizarre. So I'm going to read you highlights from what Tosig says about this. So Jesus reveals to John the entire nature of the universe, beginning with a description of God as the transcendent, invisible spirit and father. From him came the mother. So God, Father, God, the perfect father up here, creates or gives rise to or generates this being called mother, whose name in this tradition that John's being presented with here is Pronoia Barbello. Mm-hmm. Just remember his mother. Okay. I'm not going to use that name again. Although all through the book, she's referred to as Barbello. Okay. And then the son, we'll talk about how that happens in a minute, followed by a number of luminous powers. So we end up with this array of angels, archangels, aeons, Son Jesus, Adam as a sort of prototypical Eve chops down. I mean, it's just an amazing. I tried to draw a diagram of it this afternoon. I spent about an hour drawing the diagram, and I couldn't understand what I got done. So
astral rulers.
But it's really an amazing idea. The lower world, which is the one we live in, originated when the youngest of the powerful figures called eternal generations. That's the first thing that God, the all-powerful creates, God the good, is he creates this mother, and then he creates seven other, see, I'm drawing my chart here, right? Mm-hmm. Seven other entities that are called eternal generations. So, have these generations, all these beings that are coming and being out here and showing up and so forth, and the youngest of all these generations that come out of that direct connection there is named Sophia, or Wisdom. And she has the audacity to decide that she's going to have a child without talking to her God or to her one of her aeons. There's these aeon characters.
Her male partner.
Creates her male partner, which is her aeon.
Right.
And so she goes off and has this child whose name is Yaldabaoth. Yaldabaoth. The book also refers to him as chief ruler. That god, who isn't perfect because he's been created by a sub-god of a sub-god using some stolen spirit matter and some other things, he's the god who creates this earth. Mm-hmm. Okay?
The one that Sophia...
Yeah, the one that Sophia gave birth to...
Gave birth to.
Is the one who creates this earth.
Okay.
No wonder you have Mount Olympus.
That's...
Exactly. And he's called the chief ruler in lots of places. So the chief ruler forms a lower world and creates a bunch of astral rulers to work with him. Take care of things, manage things, take care of that plot over there. Which is where all these regional gods come from. Every country had its own god. Every tribe had its own god. These were astral rulers appointed by whatever his name is. I'll just call him chief ruler. And that's how the whole lower world, the world we live in, was created and generated and managed. The chief ruler and his minions create the first human. And the way this came about was that the divine image of the sun that was created by the first divine light being created by God. Mother gives rise to a son, and this son is ultimately destined to become the savior in one respect. So when the chief ruler creates this planet down here, creates this world, and he decides he wants to create human life on it, he has a big pool, and the sun, this is an interesting, because this has an interesting parallel to it, to the Genesis story. The sun looks down to see what's going on down here on this funny-looking planet, and his face is reflected in the pool, and chief ruler and his artisans decide to create a being that looks like that. That's what it means to them, what it means to be created in his image. Just they had a reflecting pool with his picture in it, and they said, oh, let's make something like that. So they do, and this becomes Adam, okay? But there's a problem. Adam can't move. He's not really live in the sense that he's got spirit and all sorts, right? Because he's just been painted from this or created from this image, right? So the chief ruler gets tricked by the aeons into breathing spirit life into this image that he and his minions have created. And the mother provides this spirit, provides this breath. And he gets tricked into implanting it in the human, and that's when the human becomes actually real. But the lowest of the, and he becomes, because he's got this breath from the mother, which remember this job, this chief ruler came down a different. He doesn't have that kind of access. So now this human is more powerful than the chief ruler. So Adam's bigger than God in that. If you want to just sort that out a little bit,
Adam's more powerful than.
Or more powerful than the creator God that they say created this planet, the chief ruler. So the chief ruler is kind of pissed off. So he does, he comes up with a clever plan for making this problem go away, and then he takes this being called Adam and he encases him in flesh, puts a body around him, which will limit his scope and his power and his ability to move. And that way, the theologians conclude, all people come to have a double heritage. They're in truth the spiritual children of God, filled with inner light and divine goodness, but at the same time, humanity has become polluted with sin and ignorance, shackled by the fetters of the mortal body and its deceptive passions, and subject to the violence and torment of malicious pretender gods who keep showing up all the time. History, it says, is the story of repeated but ineffectual attempts by the inferior world rulers. Inferior world rulers are God and his minions that run this planet. To dominate the superior humans, which they can't ever do because they're inferior to them. So there's this battle going on between the divine and the human, but in this model, humans are superior, and they always defeat these divine characters who have a lesser status. Each attempt has been countered by a savior sent by the mother into the lower world to teach humanity about their spiritual nature and strengthen them with the gift of her spirit. So mother becomes the source of the salvation of the planet and all of humanity by sending these, and one of the saviors that she sends is called an epinoia of the light, and that's a woman, female savior. And then later, Jesus, who is the Christ, comes, and he's another savior, obviously a male. So there are multiple saviors coming in at various eras when the earth needs something different, some different thing that they need salvation from. But the salvation always comes in the form of a savior who brings knowledge, understanding and awareness of their superior role over these apparent gods who seem to keep fumbling around and not getting very much done. So they're able to. So the human beings that are always able to overcome the violence, deception, injustice, and humiliation and suffering of mortal existence, and in the end, all humanity will return to this divine world above, except a few who turn back from the truth. So that's the story of creation, human life, salvation, redemption in one fairly short story. And that's most of the book of the Secret Revelation of John. It discusses that subject. And it's always Jesus talking to John, pretty much nonstop, like a long lecture.
Explaining it all to him.
Explain it to him so he gets it and understands why things are the way they are. That's sort of what we're supposed to explain.
I just realized as you were saying all of that, I was going back, I'm going, why does some of this sound familiar? And it's because in the letter of Peter to Philip, he also talks about the creation of the generations, which is a similar.
Exactly.
It had to come from that myth.
Well, in fact, there are quite a few passages in the Secret Revelation of John that clearly came from the letter of Philip to Peter to Philip, Gospel of Mary Magdalene and Pistis Sophia. I mean, there are whole passages here that are just lifted out
of
this.
Do they know which? They assume that this took it from them, as opposed to the other way around.
This one postdates that one.
Peter to Philip, Mary Magdalene, what other one?
The one called Pistis Sophia.
That's not in here.
No, that's not in here. That's not one of
the. Nag Hammadi.
And there was one other one that they didn't choose that has some fairly influential material in here too, but I can't remember what it was. So there is this, and then there's a sub-story about the creation of Eve, which is a very interesting. Some of the aeons tried to separate the flesh of Adam from the spirit so they could gain some ground back. And in the course of doing that, they took the spirit out in such a way that it created another being, which is Eve, who then became superior to Adam because she had most of the spirit. And, I mean, it's a very interesting and quite female slanted actually story. So
I would, you were saying it's you didn't really know why it wasn't included, and I would say that if what you were trying to do, if Rome's idea is to create a hierarchical spirituality religion, hierarchical religion, this would be too complicated.
Yes, might be. Well, but the
and
point
give too many outs.
Right, but my point is that this story, this kind of story with these. With what's called sometimes called the Pleroma,
right.
All of these, in a huge variety of ethereal beings and power beings that emanate down from a top god all the way down here into the earth and have all these ramifications. That's classical Greco-Roman literature.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how they explain creation in many, many times.
Very, the indigenous kinds of beliefs, what you described.
Uh-huh. You say you saw a lot of the same stories in indigenous people stories.
And it's very mother-female oriented as well.
Yes.
Oftentimes.
I was fascinated by it.
Well, I don't think they would want humans to think they were more powerful.
Well, that may be the problem, right? Is because it puts them in that position. It's a power trip.
Too,
right?
Too much power, yeah.
They didn't have science like we have it now, so explanations of why things were.
Right.
Had to be something beyond.
Right.
The yeah.
Person. So they'd have explanations.
Right.
Well, and did Constantine consider himself a god?
He did not, but he was deified after death.
So there still was a tradition there that they, so Constantine.
What'd you say?
How many, you mentioned two worlds. You called the one here was the underworld.
The lower world.
The lower world.
Yep. That's the here and now. That's the here and now, this, right.
And the only two, though. See, classically, there are three.
No, it's hurt. It's actually... probably like more like seven.
And this more like,
but the boundaries aren't clear. In this book, the boundaries aren't clear. But in other documents covering similar material, there are between five and seven as a rule.
Maybe more like what Paul went through, right?
Yes.
So it would fit some with his visions of seven. Because
What do those look like?
The seven heavens.
Seven layers or five or however many.
The seven heavens that Paul went through. I just know he did it. I could go back and find it.
So the last few chapters of this book is a dialogue, slightly reminiscent of Plato and Socrates, but in this case a student, whoever John is, asking the questions and the teacher, Christ, answering them. And I told you how the story began, so I'm going to go down here and just tell you what the questions were and what the answers were. You might get some interesting insights here. And I'm not claiming this is true. I'm just claiming this is what his book says. I mean, what the apocryphon of John says. So when John is confronted by this Pharisee, he goes wandering off into the wilderness, and as he's going, he's asking himself these questions. And the very first one is really very important and noteworthy. He asks himself, how was the Savior appointed? In other words, what was the scriptural or sacred authority for Jesus to be here and teach us and tell us to do anything? It would not occur to a first century thinker, especially one of Jewish culture, that the Christ could be by nature what he is. He'd have to be appointed by some higher authority in order to have the ability to have that kind of influence. Rabbis didn't self-ordain. That was a really interesting question for that to be the first one he would ask. Then he asked several other questions that were less important than that, and then that's when Jesus shows up. They have this presentation. And then he asks, the other questions that he asks as he's on his way out there is, after he asks who appointed him, he said, why was he sent into the world by the Father who sent him? Who is his Father anyway? Of what sort is the eternal generation to which we'll go? In other words, what happens next after we die? Now, these can be seen as plot devices because they pose questions the authors of the book anticipate their readers would be asking at that point, and which they plan to ask and answer of Jesus when he shows up on the scene. Jesus starts out his interaction with John with what I call sort of a preface. He says, hey, John, chill. It's me. You know me, you know this face, you know this voice, you know the outlines of my teachings. Settle down. What are you losing? Why are you out there screaming around and doubting? So then he goes into this long explanation we just talked about the Pleroma and all the Eve. And then when he gets done with that, John says he has some questions to ask. And Jesus says, go ahead and ask questions. So the first story, the first question he asks is, who will be saved? He asked that question, and I'll give you the references so you can look them up later. He asked that question in 23, verse 1. Who will be saved? And here's Jesus' answer. Those on whom the Spirit of life descends will be made perfect, and then they will live lives that demonstrate that they have earned salvation. So, answer the question, who will be saved? Those on whom the Spirit of life descends, who will live their lives in a way that demonstrates their connection. And then John says, so what about those on whom the Spirit of life descends but who do not do the things they need to do? And Jesus says, basically, everyone on whom the Spirit of life descends is saved, unless They allow themselves to be led astray by what he calls counterfeit spirits. You remember when I was reading through the description earlier, I said there are those people who get led astray, who become sort of disaffected, and they don't get into the final game, but everybody else does. Then John wants to know, where do these souls go after death? And it says Jesus laughs at that one, and he says they'll go to a place where they'll be safe from the counterfeit spirits. Mm-hmm. Sounds like a politician to me. I don't know. And then I keep calling him Paul. That's interesting, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Then John pursues the question more deeply. What about those who don't know the all? Where do their souls go? Jesus says, if they fail to attain salvation due to ignorance, which is what this question implies, because they don't know the all, they'll be brought to a place of learning until their forgetfulness is erased, and thus they will become perfect through knowledge and be saved. You could make an argument that that's an argument in favor of the, what's it called? Purgatory, the Catholic model. But in any case, the point is that he's saying they're not dead. They're not done yet. If it's only out of ignorance that they didn't accept the story, they get another shot. Doesn't tell what that's like, but that's what he gets. It does in some ways, doesn't it? And then John says, so where do the souls of them who understood but turned away end up? And Jesus' answer basically is they're screwed.
They're screwed.
He doesn't use that word, but he says eternal punishment will be their lot.
Oh, dear.
So if you've already had this message and you've understood it, so you've got the knowledge can never be removed from you, but you've denied the knowledge, presumably through the intervention of these counterfeit spirits we're talking about, then you're done. You're not going to achieve salvation. But that's the only category of humans who don't get saved. It's those who have been made aware of it and deliberately turned their backs on it and went in a different direction. Interestingly, that particular passage mentions a sin called blasphemy against the Holy Spirit, which is mentioned in a number of other places in the New Testament too as the unforgivable sin. Mm-hmm. Nobody's yet been able to define what that means. What does it mean to blaspheme the Holy Spirit? But whatever that is, don't do it. Not getting out of that one. And then John asks the concluding question, the last question he asks is, where did the counterfeit spirit come from? Which is getting back to the problem of evil, right? And Jesus answers him this way. As soon as I find this here. Jesus says, he made a plan with his powers, the divine creator God. They begot fate, with a capital F, fate, which is the last of the counterfeit chains. And it is such that it makes each one different from every other. And it is painful and it oppresses that soul, since the gods and angels and demons and all the generations have intermingled with it up to the present day. So what's he saying? Separation sets in. Counterfeit gods, counterfeit spirits come from the mistake of believing in separation, mistake in turning away from the unity. For from that fate appeared every iniquity and injustice and blasphemy and the fetter of forgetfulness and ignorance and every harsh command and severe sins and great fears. In other words, every single problem we face, as A Course in Miracles teaches us too, is a function of our separation, our belief in our separation from God. That was an interesting example there. Clearly, after what I've been saying so far, you could conclude that reading and interpreting this book is a bit of a daunting task. There are a number of reasons for this. One is it challenges almost all the standard teachings we have leading up to this in terms of how the world was created and where it came from and what the outcome of salvation looks like and so forth. And it particularly overrules Genesis and a lot of the Hebrew scripture in terms of that belief system. Secondly, it assumes an understanding of ancient belief systems and traditions that almost nobody has today outside of a narrow scholarship niche. They're just esoteric subjects. And much of its content, for example, comes from Jewish wisdom literature as well as Platonic dialogues. There are actually whole quotations in this, and they're lifted from the dialogues of Timaeus and Parmenides, which are Platonic dialogues. And who do you know today who even he knows is a dialogue? Well, I'm not sure how many people you know today who know what there are Platonic dialogues, but of those who do, they probably wouldn't mention those two as being among, you know, because they're pretty minor works, even in the context of Plato. So this book literally begs for a metaphysical interpretation. It needs to have somebody take a different level look at the book and really try to tease out the teachings that are here, because some of these things I've mentioned sort of obliquely here are really critical ideas that are not getting any fresh air. Like Daniel and Revelation, as Vicky was saying earlier, this apocryphon thinly disguises a wide-ranging social critique of power relationships in the world in the metaphorical language of cosmology and Revelation so that it wouldn't be easily detected and they wouldn't get arrested and thrown in jail and all that sort of stuff. Now, but some of his contemporary readers clearly understood the criticism sufficiently well that they were outraged. For the most part, their reaction was predictable for members of the establishment. They objected stridently to its portrait of a world used by ignorant and pretender gods, as Karen King said. So let's close with a couple of quotes from Karen King. I couldn't find a spot for them, but I thought they were interesting. One, she said, in contrast to Roman rulers who declared themselves the authors and enforcers of universal justice and peace, this story describes the world as a shadowed place ruled by ignorant and malevolent beings. And exposes the Roman rulers' lies and violence as violations of the true God's purpose and offers sure knowledge of humanity's true spiritual identity and destiny, which, of course, no human ruler can deal with, overcome, combat, know what to do with. So that's it. Right on time, look at that.
Whoa.